From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour goes back to, well, we think sometime in 2009. At the time, Rochester Superintendent of Schools, Jean-Claude Brizard, had brought a concept from New York City to Rochester. It's known as the rubber room. Districts have said for a long time that bad teachers are too difficult to fire because of union protections or length of legal proceedings and more. They've told us for years that to fire a teacher, you need 2 years and $200,000. So the concept of a rubber room is an alternative form of discipline. While a teacher is investigated, they are sent to a room and essentially paid not to teach. They're paid not to do anything, really, except occasionally clean. Well, unions say that the teacher removal process has been changed in the state over the past 18 months. They say there's no reason to create these rubber rooms. Some teachers have said it's demeaning. WROC-TV's Rachel Barnhart produced a piece on the rubber room this month, and we've asked her to join us to explain more about what's going on. So first of all, Rachel, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for taking an interest in our report.
And Van White is here. Van is the Rochester City School District School Board President. Van, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Evan. How are you?
Good. We're going to tackle this, among other educational issues. It's a busy time for Van, the school board, and more. Later this hour, we expect to hear from Tom Gillette, who's the Regional Staff Director of New York State United Teachers, on this issue. But Rachel, let me just briefly start with this. I know for your story, you did reach out for the Rochester City School District. They chose not to participate in your story, that's right?
Well, they only sent a statement. We gave them about a week's notice that we were pursuing the story. We told them who we were interviewing, what would be in our report. And on the day our story aired on Thursday, they sent us a statement about the rubber room, but really no answers to the specific questions we had. Since that time, I've only heard from the district with one thing about the story that they wanted to clarify. But other than that, they didn't seem to have any disputes with what we reported.
Okay. And so when it comes to defining a rubber room, I touched on that at the outset, but just briefly, again, give us the definition of what the colloquial rubber room is and what it's designed to do.
The rubber room is the term the district uses for it is the alternative work location. And that is where teachers who are under investigation for misconduct, whether these are infractions that are minor or very serious, some kind of policy violation, maybe they have even been charged with a crime. These are teachers who've been removed from the classroom, and this is where they are ordered to report to work every single day. This concept was brought to Rochester by former Superintendent Jean-Claude Brizard, who believed, as New York City did at the time, that, you know, if teachers are under investigation, they should not be able to sit at home and collect a paycheck. They should be forced to report to work every day.
Okay, and let me go ahead and read the statement that the district sent to you, if that's okay, because I want to make sure we clarify the district's position on this that they sent to WROC-TV. So this is from the City of Rochester School District. Quote, "The alternative work location is isolated from students, and employees who are assigned there receive supervision during the day instead of being paid to stay home. A far bigger waste of taxpayer money is the costly, complex, and time-consuming process required to dismiss a tenured teacher who has clearly engaged in misconduct against students and or colleagues," end quote. Van White, is it correct that there is a timely, time-consuming, costly process to just to fire one teacher?
I think that probably was true in the past. I believe, if memory serves me, changes were made to the law around 2012-2013, where the legislature, I think at the recommendation of the Board of Regents, created a more efficient, effective process. For example, prior to these changes, arbitrators, the school district and the union had to agree to the arbitrator. And until they could reach an agreement, there was no arbitration, or there was no one to supervise the resolution of the charges. The new legislation says that after a certain period of time, the commissioner, I think, picks the arbitrator. So there are a number. I think there's a 1 year statute of limitations that didn't exist before. So these things have to be pursued more judiciously. So I think that was true, Evan, but I don't think that's true now. I think by Rachel's report, Rachel, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, there were 12 people in the quote-unquote rubber room. Is that right, Rachel?
Well, at the time we interviewed, the woman that we interviewed, when she was in there last spring, there were 15. I've talked to other people who didn't want to go on camera, and they said at any given time there were about a dozen.
So that probably, in my recollection, from anecdotal evidence I received, that's probably less than there was in the past when it first started. started. Additionally, in addition to the state changes, this Board of Education has gotten more aggressively involved with 3028 proceedings, and that in thanks should be given to our former HCI, Human Capital Initiatives Director, Bethany Centrone. She got into the role of getting more aggressive with moving these things out. I'm sure Adam and Tom Gillette are very familiar with second chance agreements, whereby you reach an agreement to resolve the case, giving the employee one more chance. So HCI, again, our personnel department, got more aggressive, realized that there was a backlog, and got more aggressive with dealing with the cases that have been sitting around for a while.
All right, so you're the school board president. Are you comfortable with the notion of a rubber room?
First of all, the phrase rubber room was created by somebody, I don't know who, to connect some negative connotation to this.
Alternative work location.
Alternative work location. I am okay with that so long as the operative phrase is work location. The whole point was people shouldn't be just sitting home collecting a paycheck. I principally agree with that notion that, first of all, you're innocent until proven guilty, right? And that's true with teachers, even under 3028. But there may be safety reasons for what or whatever other considerations where you wouldn't want them in the classroom. So they're removed from the classroom, not into a rubber room, but they should be moved into a work location. Now, if they're not doing work, I could see why someone might use the phrase as a rubber room. It just drive you nuts sitting there. But the goal was, by Jean-Claude Bizard, is to get them to be on the payroll and to earn that money on the payroll. Now, if they're sitting there and they're not doing work, I have a problem with that. One, because obviously that can't be very productive. That would drive a person crazy. But two, there is lots of work to be done that doesn't necessarily involve interacting with children if that's the issue. So there's no reason why 15, 12, 20 people, God forbid that should happen. We should have a process that's efficient and effective that moves folks along, given the changes in the law and what we're doing in the Board of Education. But if there are people in that room, they should be working, and I'm good with that.
We're going to get to the phones in a moment. I think we may have a solution to our phone issue today. There may be a bit of delay, but we're going to come to you in a moment. Wes and Honeyway, others, if you want to join the conversation, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. On the subject of what the teachers are doing in the alternative work location, Rachel's piece included a former teacher, and she said that she was watching television shows.
They were watching movies. They were playing cards. They even got facials one day. Mm. She had a friend come in and give everybody facials, even the men in there. And this account has been corroborated by other people who were in the room at the same time as her and other people who have been in the room at different times, including one that was just in there this past December. They are not given work to do. Now, the district, the one thing that they did clarify about my story is they said, well, they can do work if they're proactive. They can do lesson plans. But the teachers in there say, no, we can't do lesson plans because we are not allowed to have any contact with the staff members at our home schools. So we're not allowed. We have no idea what's going on in our classrooms. We have no idea where our students are. We have no idea what's happening here. So they're not given any substantive work to do. And they really do just sit there all day long. And it's a really demoralizing experience. You know, and no one I talked to said that they enjoyed this. No one said they enjoyed just sitting there doing nothing because they don't know what the future holds. For some of them, some of them didn't even know why they were in there, but they feel stigmatized. They feel their careers could be ruined. They don't know if they're ever going to go back to teaching again. So it can be a very stressful experience.
Van, what does that sound like to you?
Well, ironically, it sounds like the in-school suspension program that we had a couple few years ago, also started up by Jean-Claude Bizard, where we had students going into rooms really not receiving any instruction, any remediation, and they too felt like, I'm sure they would call it a rubber room. It wasn't productive use of city school district resources or time. So again, let me repeat, I could see why someone would call it a rubber room if, in fact, all they're doing is sitting in there and twiddling their fingers. And I could even understand why someone would say, well, let's watch TV or let's play cards, because the district is not giving them, quote-unquote, instruction. But let's be clear about this. If an employee, for whatever reason, is subject to some disciplinary protocol, and they can't be, during the pendency of that, engaged with kids, there should be a place, and it would not be at home, in my estimation, where they can still earn the money that they're receiving. And it doesn't have to involve children. But for our district, and I don't, you know, all I can do is listen to Rachel's story and how she's corroborated that with some other folks. If that's in fact what our employees are doing, that is wrong. We should have something for them to do. It doesn't have to be developing lesson plans. God knows. I mean that literally. There's enough in this district that needs to be done that we could use the support of 10, 12, 15 people other than having them watch game shows and get manicures.
Yes. One person in the rubber room suggested, well, you know, we could make attendance calls.
Sure.
We can make calls home to parents to find out, you know, where your children are and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
I believe under the union contract, they can't be given any, you know, menial work to do.
Sure.
It has to be something that a teacher would do.
Right.
But right now they're really not being given much to do.
Sometimes the question of teacher discipline, teacher quality, et cetera, becomes a bit of a political issue, a little bit left-right, even though our governor, who's a Democrat, is certainly pushing the notion that he wants to see it easier to fire bad teachers, in his words. We can get into more of that in a moment and speak a little more broadly. But the New York Post is hardly the most liberal newspaper in the state, and they've been writing the story of what's been going on in New York City for years. Let me quote from Susan Edelman's story in the New York Post last summer. Quote, three of New York City's longest-running rubber room teachers have raked in more than $1 million each for a decade of not working in classrooms, and a fourth has paid a top salary of more than $100,000 a year not to teach. The Post goes on to detail just how long they've been there and the fact that for a decade, you've got teachers showing up there every day. Van, even if the premise is it takes a long time to fire a bad teacher, you can't put a teacher in somewhere for 5 or 10 years and keep paying them, right?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, that's just not a good way to use resources. That's not a good way to manage staff and morale. There's a whole bunch of reasons why you would not want to do something like that. And one of the questions I asked Rachel upon reading her stories, I said, well, what was the average length of stay for these folks in there? Because literally we're talking about apples and oranges when we talk about the Big Apple in Rochester. We don't, and Rachel did not have an answer. And I said, one of the differences between this Board of Education and maybe past boards of education is, while she could not get the answer to that question, given the district's response, the Board of Education certainly can, and we will. And if the average length of stay in this quote-unquote rubber room is, let's say, 6 months, that may be tolerable given the issues that are at stake. But if it's 6 years, I think we have a problem. I suspect that it is not 6 years because of the changes in the law and because this board has gotten more aggressive with respect to supervising and managing the 3028 process.
Let me get a phone call. This is Deborah in Rochester. And Deborah,
Yes, hello.
There you are. Go ahead, Deborah.
I'm not sure where to begin. I'm a retired city school district teacher, and I have a lot of experience with, and I will refer to it as the rubber room. I have never been there myself, but I certainly have many colleagues who have been there. And I'm wondering if Mr. White can speak to a couple of things. It's been my understanding with all the people I know that have been there that they have to sign something saying that they will have no contact with any students, and they are... they have to give away their privileges to district email. They have also told me that they can sit in the rubber room for weeks, sometimes even months, before the union or anybody even tells some of these people why they're there. That the former superintendent has said that because it is not a punitive place, but an alternative work location, that the right of, I can't think of the word, but to know your charges and due process, that's what I'm looking for, isn't automatically granted. So that's one issue. I know some people who have been there because of so-called inappropriate behavior, whatever, but I also know people who have been literally walked out of the building by administrators for personal and political reasons. In one case, it was somebody who was a staunch union supporter and an activist who was walked out of his school, and he spent almost a year in the rubber room. In another case, it was a woman who actually had won Teacher of the Year honors in years past, and because she spoke up and was willing to rock the boat, whatever, she was walked out one time, and there's many people like that in this location as well, and I'm not going to keep on rambling and go on and on, but maybe one of you can speak to that. Thank you.
Deborah, thanks for the phone call. And Van, that can be... It's hard. We're hearing anecdotal information. Yeah. I mean, it's sometimes it's hard to comment.
Yeah.
Do you buy the idea that teachers have been walked out for simply being sort of activists about, say, pro-union, that kind of a thing?
I don't know if they've been walked out because they're activists, but I do know it is standard protocol in a lot of businesses to literally walk people out of the building, not because you're trying to take them through some perp walk, but just having been involved in corporate America, a lot of times they will do that for security purposes.
That is true.
But I can't speak to whether that has happened to a teacher because she stood up against an administrator. It may or may not have. A couple points, though. She mentions Jean-Claude Bazard, who was our superintendent at least 3 years ago. I don't know how fresh these stories are. She did indicate that her frame of reference was Jean-Claude Bazard when he was here. I believe that things have changed substantially since then because of, one, the Board of Education, and two, because the state law has changed. As I said, Rachel wasn't able to get a time frame from the district. I will figure out how long these folks have been sitting around there. I suspect it won't take me long to get an answer. And if it appears that they are lingering there for an excessive period of time, you'll clearly see the board do something about that as well. So, I can't tell you, Evan, whether people are being treated this way. If they are, of course, it goes without saying, if they're, being forced, walked out, or sent to the rubber room because of some political or strategic purpose, that would be wrong. I do not believe that is happening. But you know what? I'm a lawyer, a civil rights lawyer, and I know that kind of stuff does happen, and it even happens in our district.
Well, here are two anecdotal things that Van might change your mind about whether it's still happening. After my story aired, I was contacted by a man who's in the rubber room right now. He told me, I do not use my name, don't use a lot of specifics about me, because he said being in the rubber room is worse than being labeled a child molester. But he did tell me that he spoke in front of the board recently, and 2 weeks later, he had some complaints, and 2 weeks later, he's found himself there, and he doesn't know why he's there. And then... Over last fall, there was a high school teacher who told me that she was only there for 2 weeks. She said she had two students who complained to the principal of inappropriate conduct. She said the students completely made it up, and she was only in there for a couple weeks. But these are some situations. These things are happening. And then another woman who is in the rubber room right now told me that there are three teachers from the same school, one of whom is a union rep, they're all in the rubber room because they just don't get along with their principal.
Evan, let me just say real quickly, and people can choose to believe this or not believe this, but if I find out that someone spoke in front of the Board of Education, with the superintendent there and seven board members there and God knows who else watching, and after that, they were put into this rubber room, that is totally unacceptable. That is not going to, if it happens.
Listen, I'm trying to get this tell his story on camera. I said, if you tell your story on camera, maybe we can get you sprung.
That's your standard, Rachel. Yeah. He doesn't even have to be on camera with us. If he's willing, and he may or may not, he may not trust people. He may not know, he may believe that because he spoke up at that podium, there are members of the Board of Education, which would not be true. But he may think, his perception may be that he got put into the rubber room because of that. If he won't speak to Rachel and he won't speak to us, I don't know how we get this situation resolved.
Yeah,
except that, let me just say, and somebody asked me the other day, they said, well, Mr. White, how come you didn't know about X, Y, and Z? Something that somebody was talking about on Facebook. The reality is we have 30,000 students, right? Thousands of employees. We can't be every place. And we do. Good public servants do rely on good media and courageous citizens and employees to step forward and tell us some of the stuff that's happening. This is the first, you can believe it or not, this is the first that I'm hearing of this. And if there's any corroboration to these facts that people are being retaliated against, it absolutely positively will not be tolerated.
All right, a couple of points here. First of all, we agree that at least a teacher in this alternative, what's the term?
Work location.
Alternative work location should they know why they're there? Should they know at least the allegations against them? I mean,
they
Rachel, you're claiming somebody
do.
Contacted you and said, I have no idea why I'm
right,
here.
Right, because he's just...
Do you believe
just,
that?
Yeah, I do, because he just landed there. And I believe it because the teachers are telling me the exact same thing. When they first go there, they have no idea. They are eventually told. They do eventually get a list of quote-unquote charges against them, but many of them don't know until they're already there.
Okay, and, you know, as Van points out, maybe there is a purpose for an alternative work location and that it becomes a rubber room if it's being used ineffectively. But, Rachel, you're using that term. I mean, do you buy the notion that that it is a rubber room right now?
You know, I use the term because that's literally how everyone knows it. It's what it's called. I'm not saying it deserves to be called that, but that is why I'm using the term. I think the story that I did raises a question over whether the rubber room is being used punitively. You know, I talked to one teacher who was in there this past fall, and she said, you know, there were people in there who really should not be teaching children. There were people in there who, by their own admission, did some things that were pretty not good. They shouldn't be in the classroom. But then she said, but then there were people like me and some other people who maybe just had just didn't have a good relationship with their principals or maybe had a student not tell the truth about them. And so she said there really was a wide range of people. And then that raises a question of process. What's the appropriate process? What is the appropriate process here?
Also, you mentioned in your piece the question of why some teachers were there. Adam Urbanski told Rachel for the story, quote, we had one teacher, a spectacular teacher, who was put in there because she said, go Obama, during the 2008 election. Without more details on that, it's hard to know. I mean, are you saying to every student who walks into your class, go Obama, as in are you using
sure.
it to kind of put or did you say it one time?
Well,
I mean, I don't have any context
right,
for but that.
But I think the point here that I was trying to make, and a lot of people, we interviewed a retired teacher who had nothing to lose. She was kind of the star of our story. She was the only one willing to go on camera and say, I had this experience. She was the only one in 5 years that I'd been looking into the rubber room who was willing to go on camera and say, this is what it was like. And a lot of people were asking me a ton of questions about, well, what did she do? What happened? And I deliberately didn't want to make it a he said, she said, because the story to me was about process. The story was about what's happening in this room. The story was about, is the room being used properly? It wasn't so much about what happened to each individual teacher in there. I think it's safe to say, given the number of people that I've talked to about this, that it does run the gamut. You have a lot of different reasons why people are in there, and some appear to be very legit, and others are a little questionable.
Okay, but for you as a reporter, this teacher who was in your story, it was immaterial why she was there.
It wasn't immaterial. No, I mean, if she had been arrested or charged with a crime, I think that would be different. But I had absolutely no indication that she had done anything, very severe here.
Okay.
And by the way, I mean, no one has since contacted me since this story aired that she had done anything, you know, really horrible. And she claims that but if you want to get into what we can, I mean, she claims that she had a student in her class who was extremely difficult and that she kept asking for help. The student ended up being moved into a different classroom. And she said, is that teacher going to get help? And the principal said yes. And she says, well, why didn't I get help? And she said the next day she was in the rubber room. She said when she was presented a list of charges, there were a number of very minor incidents going back a number of years of her employment. Things that I think she said she was accused of throwing a snow cone at a student. And she says, well, actually, the student threw a snow cone at me. And she said just a number of little incidents like that that were given to her in a list of charges. She said that the district hired an investigator to investigate all this while she was in the rubber room and that he just couldn't find anything, but that her case just wasn't resolved. And so after 4 months, she said, I can't stay here anymore. I need to retire. Now, I don't know if any of that is true. I have no way of finding out if any of this is true or not. But I thought that what she had to add to the conversation was important enough to let people know that there is a group of people after spring break is over on Monday that are going to be reporting to a portable classroom outside of an empty school. They will be sitting there doing nothing.
And taxpayers
all day,
are
and taxpayers
it.
Are paying for it.
Yeah, Van, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, as I sit here and listen to these stories, they're a third person, and in my business, my other line of work, it would be considered hearsay, but nonetheless, still information that we ought to be listening to. If I believe every word that has been spoken to Rachel, I think that little trailer ought to be shut down. But I have a higher, and the Board of Education has a higher responsibility than just listening to third-hand stories. But part of that responsibility is when we're given this kind of information, I think it does open the door for us to take some responsibility. So listening to this information, my inclination right now is to send an email, and I will as soon as I'm done here, to my six colleagues on the Board of Education saying we ought to investigate what the status is of our alternative work location. And part of that investigation should include, begin with, understanding what's the average stay there. Secondly, what are the employees doing when they are there? And third, and none of this is in order, what are the offenses for which a person can be directed into the alternative work location? I think that's the board's responsibility upon hearing information like this. And I am determined, and knowing my colleagues quite well, that will happen. Because we can't have, I mean, if these allegations are true, teachers are our employees, and they're entitled to, I think the due process phrase was used earlier on, they are clearly entitled to due process. I can't imagine a scenario under which you'd be sent to that room and not told, again, assuming that this is true, I know it's true, that you would not be told why you were being sent to that room. That's, you know, we don't live in that kind of society.
Right.
And we certainly do not want employees working in that kind of district.
The whole point that Adam Urbanski made about the teacher who allegedly said, go Obama, and ended up in the room, you need more information than that, don't you? I mean, I don't know the context of that.
Well, and let's assume that that's true. That would be, I'm laughing because that would be absolutely outrageous, right? We're teaching kids about a democratic society, and a teacher can't say, go Obama. Now, the reality is, truth is probably somewhere between go Obama and whatever is on the other spectrum of the facts here. We don't know what those facts are, but this much you can depend on. We will look at those three factors and determine whether that alternative work site is providing the service that our children need and that our teachers need.
All right. I need to get a 60-second break, and when we come back, we're going to bring in Tom Gillette, the regional staff director at NYSET, on the question of whether the whole notion that the City of Rochester School District raised to Rachel Barnhart is true, that it is too laborious and costly to fire bad teachers, and that maybe this alternative work location, in their view, is a more effective use of taxpayer dollars. So let's take this 60-second break. If you want to call the program, you can. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. We'll continue next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the Next Connections, President Obama set off a bit of a firestorm at the National Prayer Breakfast when he referenced the Crusades. He said no religion should kill in its name, and he referred to the Crusades. Now, some Christian leaders have said he got it wrong, that those were justified wars. What's the reality? We're going to talk to a number of educators about what the Crusades were all about on Wednesday.
A lesson from the Ebola crisis, the disease has been deadliest for the youngest patients, but children's chances of survival may go up with extra love and affection.
We play games, put pictures on the walls, and do whatever we can to try and minimize the horror that the poor kids are going through.
That story today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Van White is in studio. He's the Rochester City School District School Board President. Rachel Barnhart's a reporter and anchor at WROC-TV who's been reporting on this so-called rubber room. And on the line with us is Tom Gillette, the Regional Staff Director at New York State United Teachers. Tom, thanks for taking the time.
Of course.
Let me just start very briefly with the question of whether it is true that firing a teacher, I always hear 2 years, $200,000. And I even heard it from a teacher in a Wayne County district last night who said, hey, I mean, as far as I know, it's still 2 years, $200,000. Is that no longer true, Tom?
3020A, the law that outlines this process, has been modified by the legislature four times since 2008 to address what certainly was a problem for many, many years of a lengthy process that sometimes could go years. The data that we have that's most recent, which is a year old, indicates that 90% of the 3020A hearings are concluded within 90 days. There may still be some that go as long as a year. But that's really the exception to the rule. The changes in the law have really made some efficiencies in the process, and it's simply not based on fact when people make those claims.
I got a note from Martin who says, unions always protect the worst among the teachers. That's why we need to be more aggressive. Tom, you've been hearing that for years. And I'd like to get your take on, first of all, on Martin's comment, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about the process. But what do you say to that?
Well, I happen to be a big fan of due process. And I think it's a fundamental concept that our entire society in this country embraces, which is that an individual is innocent until proven guilty. In fact, Dan White had said that exact same thing. And I think that's a good concept. It works in the criminal justice system, and that's the basis for the 3028 provisions. There are ways to address certain situations, and they are also outlined in the law, and school districts can and should exercise those exceptions to the rule, but I think due process is something, heaven forbid, any of us should need it ourselves, but we would want to have that there.
We're talking about how to improve education, and this is just one component here. Now, Governor Cuomo has said that this is one of his driving issues in education this year, that we have to be able to fire bad teachers, that it's too difficult, that our students deserve better. The governor's made it a kind of rallying cry, whereas many other people I've talked to, many retired superintendents, many teachers, people like Bill Calla out in Fairport, have said that is a red herring, that yes, you want to be able to remove bad teachers, but they are a very small percentage, and especially in urban centers, the biggest issue is poverty. It's not educational reform or some magic elixir. It's fixing the concentration of poverty. That's what Bill Calla said. I asked Mayor Lovely Warren last hour, what side are you on? And she essentially said she thinks that's an excuse, that you cannot make an excuse, that poverty is not an excuse, and that we have to look at ways to improve on all angles here. Let me ask Van and then Tom that question. Van, you know, the mayor said don't make poverty an excuse, whereas Bill Calla says, let's be honest about the problem here.
Well, really briefly, I have often said poverty is not an excuse, but it is an explanation as to why I think urban children struggle to get some of the scores that our suburban colleagues get in Brighton and Pittsford and Riga. For example, everyone knows that the city housing stock has more properties built prior to 1975 than, let's say, for example, Brighton. And the maintenance on those properties is quite limited. For years, for decades, we've had children living in substandard housing. And you all, know the impact of lead poisoning on children. Once it gets into your system from those windows going up and down, that friction, it permanently affects a child's cognitive and some studies show even their behavioral abilities. Additionally, who can argue the impact of going to school on an empty stomach, right? Who can argue the impact of what explanation might be offered by a child who cannot sleep because there's shots being fired at night and he or she is afraid to sleep at night? Who can argue about how a child might be traumatized by going through neighborhoods where they're seeing all kinds of criminal activity? So clearly, poverty is not an excuse, but it is an explanation. It puts the performance of our children and the challenges of our teachers in an appropriate context. Now, one other thing about the governor's pitch. What's troublesome to me is that when he talks about teachers and getting rid of quote-unquote bad teachers, I don't think he's talking about, because we all would agree if a teacher molests a child or if there's an allegation that a teacher molests a child, he or she is entitled to due process but should be removed from the classroom. There's no argument there. What we're talking about is what is a bad teacher from a performance perspective. And the concern that I have is this bad teacher is often judged by a set of standards that is not altogether clear that are the appropriate standards. This testing preoccupation that this country, that this state, that even the city has, based on a set of scores, based on a platform that not even teachers were involved in. I have concerns about removing teachers when people in the legislature, people in the educational community are saying those standards may not be the right standards by which to judge. How is it, Evan, for example, a couple few years ago, we had schools that were performing well in excess of the state standards. And then the standards change, and now all the scores are low, and now we want to get rid of, quote unquote, all these bad teachers. Did poverty change? No. Did the students change? No. Did the teachers change? No. The measurement, the yardstick change. So everybody should be concerned about judging teachers as bad based on a yardstick that is changing. That's my concern.
Tom Gillette, what do you make of the governor's comments? And again, if you're just joining us, the governor has said repeatedly that this year he wants to see tougher evaluations, more tied to scores, and more opportunity to get rid of bad teachers.
Well, I think, and Van did an excellent job of cataloging the different factors. I would just add one thing to that, that as a result of all of those things, or many of those things, we have a difference in the rate at which kids attend school in urban districts compared to their suburban and even rural counterparts that really kind of provide foundation to that not a remarkable concept that if kids aren't there, you can't teach them. So that's another factor that is exacerbated by what urban poverty and all the conditions bring to that. I would point out that we've got somewhere in the vicinity of 250,000 teachers in New York State, 250,000 to 300,000 when you count everybody. The governor's preoccupation with the bad teachers, however he intends to define that, is really talking about a tiny percentage. There has to be, if in fact this is a concern, and I think the members of the profession have a concern too, there's got to be a better way to do it than the one prescription for everybody, which is increase the emphasis of testing, increase that factor in a teacher's evaluation to 50%, and then let the chips fall where they may. Well, guess what? Kids in the cities and in the second-tier cities don't do as well on those tests as their counterparts in the suburbs. So are we going to conclude that the teachers are terrible? I don't think that's a logical conclusion. It's not based on fact or research, and the governor needs to be disassociated from that.
Every phone line's lit up. We're going to get to the phones in just a second, and we're going to try to move as quickly as we can. But before I do that, I want to get one more point on this notion of process of teacher removal, because in response to Rachel Barnhart's story on WROCTV.com, there are a number of comments, and Mark wrote to Rachel after the story about firing a teacher. Quote, "The process has 21 components and can often take several years to complete. Frankly, I'm tired of hearing from the unions the great injustices foisted upon their members. What about the students? If rubber rooms are protecting students until a teacher is fired, then I'm in favor of their existence." But Tom Gillette, does that process still have 21 components, and can it take years?
I don't know what the other respondent is counting as components, so I can't do a tally. But the data, and this is state education department data, indicates that 9 out of 10 3020A charges are resolved within 90 days. So I mean, to me, data is convincing, and that's what the data is.
Van, in terms of your experience with this, is Mark simply off base there with 21 components on this process? That does that sound wrong to you?
I really can't honestly say what he's speaking about. 21
okay.
components.
All right, let me try to move through the phone calls as best we can here. This is Doris in Rochester. Go ahead, Doris.
I did want to ask Rachel Barnhart. She went to Monroe High School, and if she thought at the time that she was going to a wonderful urban school. And the reason I say that is that we did have very, very good, and we have had very, very good achievement and excellent education in Rochester in the past. And we've been kind of in a tailspin, decline, and the answers to all of this have been pretty much to attack the teachers, to attack the students for being poor. We know that family income is a major and so it's not going to be a surprise that whatever test they put in, that students who are poor are not going to achieve as well. And part of that is because they're going to impoverished schools. The materials that I had when I was teaching in the city school district didn't even come close to what my fellow teachers had in suburban districts. And so I'd like to call attention to the fact that we're looking at this as if, you know, it's really true that we have so many bad teachers. And I'm just up on the side, I will say that I know a lot of teachers who have retired because of harassment from administrators. And overall, when I resigned in protest, and my comment was that now it's all politics and no policy, and there's no way to give good education to my students.
Doris,
thank you.
Thanks for the call, Doris.
I'll briefly answer that. I went to Marshall High School, not Monroe, and at the time I went there in the early 90s, it was pretty bad. I mean, there was a very high dropout rate. There was a lot more violence, I think, than you see in schools today. Our city was more violent at that time. However, I had wonderful teachers. I was able to take AP classes, and I was able to graduate and go to Cornell University. I had wonderful teachers, and I strongly believe that if the opportunities are there to take those high-level classes, then your kids can do very well in city schools.
All right, let me get Lucia in Rochester. Go ahead, Lucia.
Yeah, hi, great show, and really appreciate the opportunity to speak to Mr. White and Tom Gillette. So my question comment is, I had a colleague who was put in the alternative workstation as a result of a couple of students telling untruths about what he had done to them. And he missed several months of instruction when this got ironed out, when eventually it was found out that, indeed, they had not told the truth. But in the meantime, the loss of instruction to his students was just terrible, because they had to find substitute teachers in order to fill his shoes. And so what I'm wondering is, has there been a study done or a number, percentage to be found out of teachers who are placed there as a result of unfounded accusations on the part of students? And also, in response to what Mr. White said about lead poisoning, I totally agree with him. You know, we don't know how many children are affected by lead poisoning. It's a really frightening to consider. And if that's the case, I'm wondering what is going to be the impact, knowing that we have kids who are traumatized or have severe behavioral issues regardless. What's going to be the situation when we pull the ICOT teachers out of the classrooms and put on the consultation mode? And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Lucia, thank you. Van, you want to start?
Yeah. In terms of allegations relating to child molestation, you know, the state, for example, state law, and I think rightly so, makes a whole classification of folks mandatory reporters. So if there's allegations that someone is being abused, an adult is abusing a child, the district employees have an obligation to identify that particular employee, whether it's a colleague or not. The point here being that whenever there are allegations that a child has been mistreated or abused, anybody who's involved, anybody who loves children, has to take those allegations very seriously. Having said that, that doesn't mean that the employee that's accused is not entitled to due process. But, with all due respect, it wouldn't make any difference how many other times, and I hope she takes this in the spirit in which I mean it, it wouldn't make any difference how many times people have been accused and had been exonerated. Accused by children and then subsequently exonerated. Because the law, and more importantly, our society values children so much that we are almost overprotective. So when someone makes an allegation that an adult has abused a child, I'm not looking back to see, okay, well, these other instances, these particular people were exonerated. We got to look at this one particular child. And that doesn't mean, I do not know, that that child could be making false allegations. We see it all the time. But I think our society has said, we value our children so much, we deem them so vulnerable, that we almost have to be overly cautious about that. So I don't doubt that people have been falsely accused as an attorney. I've seen that happen many times. As a prosecutor, I've seen that happen many times. But I think it's important that we protect our children at all costs. In terms of, you know, what effect it will have on, you know, removing teachers from the classroom and what effect that has on children, certainly we have to take that into account. But again, we have to value the safety of our children. And I don't know that there's anybody, whether you're a union or non-union member, who wouldn't agree with that notion, that at all costs protect the children. But at the same time, ensure that there is due process that is efficiently and effectively gets our staff through that process and gets them out. I can tell you, there are administrators who I'm aware of that have been falsely accused by young people, relatives, by the way. I can tell you that there are teachers that have been falsely accused by young children. But again, we value the safety of our children, and we have to be cautious.
I would say that not all teachers who are placed in the rubber room are accused of molestation. There is one, however, who I believe is still in there, whom was recently accused of endangering the welfare of a child. It was involved in inappropriate touching, and that case is now sealed. I can't find out what happened to that teacher. That indicates to me the charges were dropped, and I'm trying to find out. But because it's sealed by law, I can't. And he's still in the rubber room. So we have seen cases where legally the case was resolved, but the teachers still stay in the rubber room. The district is in a really difficult position when that happens, because I've covered cases. Well, one case in particular sticks out to me. This is way before the rubber room even existed. There was a school sentry at Madison who was actually criminally charged with a felony of sexually abusing a student, a seventh grader. This was back in 2000, I think, or 2001, and I did a story on it. He was found not guilty, and he was returned to work. About 5 years later, he was arrested again, charged with abusing many, many students, and he's now in prison for a very long time. So the district's in a really tough spot, I think, when each of these cases comes up. And for those cases, there's not easy answers, but not all of the cases in the rubber room are like that.
Let me grab one more quick phone call, if I could. Anne Marie in Rochester. Go ahead, Anne Marie.
Hi. I'd just like to add another piece to this equation. We talk frequently, and the governor subscribes to this notion that there's such a thing as good teachers and bad teachers. And the part that's missing is the idea of meaningful, sustained, site-specific professional development, so that those teachers who are struggling can get the assistance they need that's appropriate for them in their particular teaching assignment. The professional development that I'm most aware of is one-shot, 50-minute workshops before the start of the school year. Teachers don't have enough time to collaborate and share best practices to visit one another's classrooms. And professional development is frequently one size fits all, which we know is not the case. An elementary teacher teaching in RCSD is going to have a different professional development need than a high school math teacher in Fairport. But yet, they may receive the same sorts of training before the school year begins. So I'd like to know from Van what his idea is about improving the nature of teaching in the city schools, and really, how can we do that in a sustained way that moves people along the continuum to being better?
Well, I can only speak by way of the most recent example, and we unfortunately don't have a lot of time to talk about this. But I think what we and I'm referring to RTA, Bente, ASAR, RAP, and of course the administration and the University of Rochester put together with the University of Rochester serving as EPO, perhaps will be a transformative model that in the area of professional development. Because one of the things that that particular initiative includes is sort of directed and guided professional development. Right now, as I understand it, teachers throughout this district have to have so many hours of professional development, but they get to choose what that is. And there may be some folks who may not agree with me on this. I think professional development, this is just my experience, my observation, is kind of haphazard, catch as catch can. It doesn't necessarily address those issues that this particular caller is talking about. And I do think that with some collaborative conversations, we should be able to come up with a plan that addresses those needs that our urban teachers have that suburban teachers do not. To answer your question, I don't think that exists, but do I think it could happen? Yes, because what we put together at East High School, and again, that was the unions were involved in that discussion, is sort of a directed effort to make sure teachers get the kind of professional development that they need.
Will you come back on a separate day, and we'll
Absolutely.
Put together a panel and just talk about what's going on at East High School? It's fascinating.
That'd be awesome.
And important story. We're going to do that in a separate time. Tom Gillette, about a minute left here. What about professional development? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree that it ought to be more focused on what the real problems are and appropriate for the staff that's being, for lack of a better expression, I'll say subjected to it. If not, it's not a good use of time or money.
Tom, thanks for taking the time to join the conversation from NYSA today. Obviously, the interest is very, very high based on the volume of calls and feedback. And the question on teacher removal, it's good to get an update on this. So I appreciate your time today, and thanks for calling the program.
You're welcome. I'll just make the observation that there's more agreement on this issue than there is disagreement between the board and the union. So I think this is something that we ought to be able to work on more effectively.
Thanks, Tom. That's Tom Gillette from NYSED, New York State United Teachers. And I will also let our listeners know, you know, we are constantly reaching out to, say, the governor's office, his department. I mean, I want that voice in the conversation. Sometimes it's harder to get, but we're still pursuing that kind of angle for those who want to come in and join the conversation. Some final thoughts from Van. It sounds to me like you are ready now to try to pursue more information after Rachel's reporting and looking forward here.
Yeah, again, it's a job that you can't be every place at every time, and sometimes other people are at places where you can't or are not, and our job is to follow up on that, and we will do that. I hope to be able to report back to you the next time I come on the air and to Rachel what we've done as a follow-up.
Well, one of these days, Van, we'll just talk about, you know, general education, what's going on
Absolutely.
In the district. We'll talk about East High. So I know we'll talk to you very soon in
okay.
this program. And Rachel, thanks for taking the time. If people want to see your report and read more, where do they go?
Probably the easiest thing to do is go to our website, rochesterhomepage.net, or you can go to my Facebook page, facebook.com/rochester.net. Rachel, and thank you so much for highlighting this story. I think it raises a number of questions.
Well, a lot of interest in this these 2 hours. Val has had a long 2 hours. Our engineer is one of the best. And thank you, Val, for putting up with me and our phone system and all of the great callers we had today. Hope we were able to get to your call, and if not, join the conversation on a future day. I'm Evan Dawson, and thank you for listening to Connections on member-supported public radio.